This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Josh Cosman, predicts that we're on the verge of the next great credit crisis, not because of credit cards or student loans. The credit crisis he's predicting is from the actions of private equity firms. These are firms that buy companies with the help of huge loans and typically try to resell the companies or take them public before the loans come due. The companies that have been bought and sold are then often left with the debt. Cosman explores how private equity firms manage to make big profits while nearly destroying some of the companies they buy and sell in his new book, The Buyout of America. He says many private equity-owned companies are defaulting on their debts, and that will mean more people losing their jobs, and it will have global consequences for the credit market. Private equity firms have purchased companies in a variety of industries, including hospital and nursing home chains, mattress companies, newspapers, radio stations, hotel chains, and record companies. Some of the biggest private equity firms are the Carlyle Group, Blackstone Group, and Kohlberg Kravis Roberts. Josh Cosman is a financial reporter for the New York Post and a former editor at MergerMarket.com and a former writer for the Deal and Buyouts newsletter. Josh Cosman, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the basics. What is a private equity company?
A private equity company or a private equity firm, there's only about 100 major firms. Maybe there's 300 overall. Many of them are in New York. And there are these small groups of people who raise money from mostly from public pensions to buy companies. And they buy companies by having just the way that you or I would arrange a mortgage. We'd put maybe 20% down and borrow 80%. But the critical difference is when they buy companies, they put 20% down, and then the companies they acquire borrow the 80% to finance the deal. So then the companies are responsible for that debt. So basically, private equity firms, which is a fancy way for or a nice way of saying a leveraged buyout firm, go around the country and they buy companies using basically mortgage tactics, but where the company takes the risk and not them.
You know, when I read that in your book, I actually couldn't believe it. <'Cause> I really don't understand how that works. That I buy your company and then you have to pay the debt for me to buy you? Why?
It's pretty insane. When my first job covering the industry, I've covered the industry for about 13 years, was at a trade publication called the Buyouts Newsletter. And I didn't know what a private equity firm was or a buyout was. I just thought it was an interesting job in Manhattan and it looked like it was worth taking. And it took me, I think, maybe 2 or 3 months into the job before I really figured that out. And it shocked me too.
So why is it that way?
It's really because of this giant tax loophole. And the giant tax loophole is called interest tax deductibility. And this is why LBOs are generally profitable for the private equity firm. Any company can deduct the interest they pay on loans from their taxes. So if you buy a company and you buy it with all this debt financing, well, now suddenly you're basically not paying taxes anymore. And because of that, that company then can, in theory, use that money to pay off its debt quickly. Reality is this is not the way it typically plays out, but in theory, that's the way it works.
So theoretically, with a private equity company,
right,
they buy a company, they use debt to buy the company that they've bought has to pay off the debt, but they could deduct the interest from their taxes. And
right,
theoretically, the company that's being purchased should make a profit over time, should be more profitable in the next 5 years. And then the company that bought this company can sell it at a profit. Everybody wins because the company that's purchased becomes more profitable. The company that bought that company sells the company at a profit. So theoretically, everybody's happy. Is that the way the perfect model looks?
That's the way that the perfect model looks, but it rarely ever works out that way. Typically, what happens is the company is more profitable in one sense. Its earnings increase, usually because the private equity firm is starving the company a bit of capital, because that's a private equity firm, and I should have said this at the start, they're in the business of buying and selling companies within 4 or 5 years. So there's no long-term interest. So typically, and a Davos study shows this, private equity firms eliminate more workers than their direct competitors. And at the same time, they usually decrease investment in research and development and capital expenditures. That helps the companies they buy pay off their debt more quickly. And, you know, typically, you know, while the companies become more profitable short term until that pressure causes them to be less competitive, what it also – but, you know, at the same time, the company still has interest to pay on the debt. It may have to take – may be able to take it off your taxes, but you still have to pay the interest. So typically, these companies actually are much less profitable than when they buy them.
Give us an example of an industry in which there's been a lot of private equity buys. And the industry, the whole industry in a way, has been squeezed with a lot of layoffs and cuts within what the business does.
Sure. An easy example is the mattress industry. Private equity firms bought Sealy and Simmons about a decade ago. Actually, it's 2009, so let's say 15, 18 years ago. And then they bought and sold them between each other. But buyout firms acquired are private equity firms. And private equity firms, by the way, I should also note, these are the same guys who were the leveraged buyout kings of the 1980s, the exact same people often. But when leveraged buyouts got a bad name, when Michael Bilken went to jail, when movies like Wall Street were made, they underwent a marketing change and very cleverly started calling themselves private equity firms. But they're one and the same. In the mattress industry, private equity firms bought Sealy and Simmons, the number one and number two brands by a mile. They stopped really competing against each other. They cut costs and they raised the prices of the mattresses. They started focusing only on the top end and stopped even making mattresses really for middle-income people that cost less than $1,000. So basically simplifying this over time is they bought the Simmons and sold it to another PE firm 3 or 4 years later. And same with Sealy. The sellers would make a lot of money. And the buyers felt, well, we can keep raising prices because there's no competition. We own Sealy and we own Simmons. It's different firms, but they both have the same aim, to make a short-term profit, not to beat each other up on price. What happened over time was they couldn't raise the prices anymore, and the prices were raised double the price of inflation, double the rate of inflation. They cut the beds in half. So you came up with no-flip mattresses. That cut their manufacturing costs.
Let's explain for a second. I thought, great, no-flip mattresses. You don't have to go through the work of flipping it, and the bed's kind of extra good, so you don't have to flip it. but there's another reason why you don't have to flip it.
That's right. Initially, they made the mattresses thick. They kept creating thicker and thicker mattresses, so they had an excuse to keep raising and raising the prices. So they thought both Sealy and Simmons both had the same thought. The private equity firms that owned them both thought, well, why don't we cut costs significantly and cut the beds in half and introduce these no-flip mattresses? Simmons did it first, early this decade. Sealy stood back. Sealy even made a statement when Simmons did it saying, we would never offer a no-flip mattress. That's why you should buy our mattresses. Simmons's sales didn't rise, but their earnings went through the roof. The private equity firm that owned Sealy at the time, which was Bain Capital, the same firm that Mitt Romney owned during that period, the Republican presidential candidate, decided, okay, well, we'll change tack. You know, even though our market share is growing, their earnings are going through the roof, and that's what we care about. So then they introduce no-flip mattresses. And now, and for the last 6 or 7 years, Sealy and Simmons only offer no-flip. There are no two-sided beds anymore.
But are there no-flips any better or worse than the two-sided ones?
Well, they certainly have a less of a life. You can't flip them. So just like a tire, you know, when you rotate your tire, you know, beds that used to last 15, 20 years on average, and those are Sealy and Simmons beds, now these beds last 6, 7 years. So it's a much cheaper bed. And what ended up happening in the middle of this decade is Tempur-Pedic came out of nowhere. And Tempur-Pedic offered a very nice sleep on, I guess they call it, you know, it's those foam beds. And those mattresses on the high end, which is all the Sealy and Simmons at this point we're now competing in, they started to really outsell Sealy and Simmons. For Sealy and Simmons, not only were they losing market share, now their earnings were starting to fall.
What's the state of Sealy and Simmons now?
Now they're both in a really tough state. Simmons just went bankrupt and it got bought by Serta. So that means Simmons, a company that's been around for more than 100 years, doesn't exist anymore. A quarter of their employees were laid off in the last year. And now, I shouldn't say, the private equity firm that owned Serta bought them and says they'll keep them independent, but that's a little hard to buy. As far as Sealy, they were veering towards bankruptcy, and their private equity owner, Kolber Kravis Roberts, put in some more money in the company to keep it going. But Sealy is also having some problems, though. They're probably a step above where Simmons is. If you look at it historically, though, Sealy's market share around 1990, when the first buyout of Sealy happened, was about 28%. Today, they're at about 20%. So I certainly believe that private equity firms, you know, from the time of 1990 through today, have not done Sealy any favors, although those private equity firms, by buying and selling Sealy to each other, have generally made huge profits, but in the process have hurt the business.
So let's look at the hospital industry. You say that the hospital industry has been especially hard hit by private equity takeovers. Why the hospital industry?
They like the hospital industry, and in some ways, although it's a very different product, it's like the mattress industry. They want to, you know, the private equity firms like to put out this myth that they help restructure businesses. They buy companies by putting companies in debt. Banks would never lend money to those companies unless they felt those companies would likely be able to pay that money off. So they are looking for companies that are healthy, usually that are not fast growers, and that they think will have dependable cash flow no matter what happens. So if they cut employees, cut research and development spending, if they starve these companies, that these companies, at least in the short term, won't be hurt competitively. That was the theory with mattresses, and it's also the theory very much in the hospital industry, that if you buy a hospital and it's the only game in town, you buy a hospital chain, but if a lot of their hospitals are the only game in town, well, then patients, if they're getting worse service, probably won't leave for a while. And that's really the theory. And patients usually leave when doctors leave. And doctors typically do not leave a hospital very quickly. They're pretty conservative in the way that they their relationships with hospitals.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. These are not hostile takeovers. So if you're a nursing home or a hospital chain or a large music company, why would you let a private equity firm buy you, knowing that it's going to put you into debt, knowing that your company is likely to be squeezed in order to show profits on the books in the short term? Why would you want that? Why would you allow that?
It's a very good question, and I think the sellers in most cases don't realize much of what we're talking about. Very little has been written about the destructive nature of private equity. Certainly the investment bankers that help sell companies, it's not in their interest to put that out there. That's even if they really have put it together. I believe that I've talked to some sellers who somewhat regret what they did, and I spoke to them for the book. Some of them didn't make the book. They didn't want to be on record. But the sense I get is when you're selling a business, you're looking for the most money you can make. And if a private equity firm offers the most money, and sometimes they certainly do, that's what you're focused on. In a pretty revealing interview to me, the CEO, the former owner of a company called Alpha Shirt in Philadelphia, in your town, spoke to me, and he explained himself as he had run this family business that basically imprints shirts. They buy shirts from Hanes, imprint them, and then and they're a huge company. And he said when he was ready to sell, his sons weren't ready to run the business. They were just teenagers. He was ready to get out. It was his father's business and his father's business before that. They offered the best price. And, you know, he didn't do a lot of due diligence. He didn't really call around, although he was given the names of other owners who've sold their companies to private equity firms.
You predict that the buyout of many companies by private equity firms is going to cause a big credit crisis, similar to the mortgage crisis. Let's look at some of the reasons why you predict that. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Private investors this decade, these private equity firms, use the same cheap credit that caused the housing bubble to buy 3,100 U.S. companies. Those companies employ one out of every 10 Americans, about 7.5 – it was 10 million people. So they've resold some of those companies. So say today it's about 7.5 million people. So private equity firms are the largest employers in the country when you combine the companies they own by a mile, bigger than Walmart, bigger than anybody. The cheap credit that was used to buy these companies, a lot of the debt on that is starting to come due just now, and it will do so over the next few years. The Boston Consulting Group, a pretty conservative organization, predicts that half of those companies will default on their debt by the end of 2011. If that comes to pass—
That's half of the companies that were purchased by private equity firms?
That's right. That's right. So half of that, exactly. So if half of those companies, so roughly 1,500 U.S. companies, end up filing for bankruptcy, and those companies fire about 50% of their workers, not the most aggressive estimates, you've got about 1.9 million people unemployed. That's a huge hit. Now, beyond that, you know, and that obviously reduces consumer spending, means more home foreclosures, all sorts of problems. The companies that are will be defaulting owe about $1 trillion in debt. And if a significant amount of those loans become worthless, that'll cause a freeze in lending. To compare, about $1 trillion in debt in companies is similar to in 2007 when subprime mortgages in this country were about $1.3 trillion. So it's, the numbers are pretty close. And even if the economy recovers more than it has today, many of these companies will collapse anyway because they're under such tremendous pressure. But I certainly do believe that the way we are right now, the economy is today, it created such a bubble to allow private equity firms to buy companies using cheap credit, paying very high prices, putting little money down, that just like the housing market, unfortunately, a lot of these companies the private equity firms bought in this bubble are due to collapse.
You know, another comparison to the housing market, the now famous CDO is collateralized debt obligations, which is basically mortgage debt that was sliced and diced and packaged and sold and resold in the form of, you know, exotic instruments, as they say. there's an equivalent for the private equity companies. They have CLOs, corporate loan obligations. So explain how CLOs compared to CDOs and why that might cause a problem.
Sure. It's very similar. The same hedge funds that were creating CDOs, which caused the mortgage market to boom, also created what were called collateralized loan obligation funds, which made it much easier for companies to borrow money to finance these LBOs. Same situation where hedge funds would come in, mostly it was hedge funds, it was also banks. They would buy a pool of loans to support LBOs, just like they would buy a pool of mortgages. Maybe they'd buy a pool of 150 to 200 LBO loans, slice them up and resell them to places like sub-Saharan African countries, Montana's state government, selling this off as this is very safe because it's 150 to 200 loans. And even if a few default, you're going to get paid, guaranteed. And Standard & Poor's and Moody's, the rating agencies, gave these CLOs, just like they gave CDOs, AAA ratings. So they gave them very much their stamp of approval saying these are very safe investments. And in the mortgage markets, as we know now, these are far from safe. And unfortunately, in the LBO market, and which has a huge impact on this country because these are 3,000 companies that employ one out of every 10 of us, unfortunately, a lot of these companies are going to collapse and a lot of these CLOs also will prove to be nearly worthless.
So has there been any problem yet? Have people lost money on their CLOs, or is this something that you think might happen sometime in the future, maybe?
I think mostly this is something that very likely will happen and is starting to happen, but has not happened yet. I mean, this year, kind of quietly, for the last 12 months, we've had an 11% default rate in this country. That's near historic highs. And half of the companies that have defaulted, it's about 175 companies so far, have had private equity involvement. Those are companies like Chrysler, like Reader's Digest, like Simmons Mattress that we talked about before. So unfortunately, the tsunami of defaults is already starting.
You write about how private equity firms are really connected to powerful people who are or have been in government. You mentioned several former Treasury secretaries have gone from the cabinet to private equity. Name some of the Treasury secretaries who are in private equity now.
It's really amazing. Four of the last eight Treasury secretaries are in the private equity industry. They include James Baker, include Nicholas Brady, Paul O'Neill, and John Snow. And John Snow, in some ways, it may be the most interesting case and show how those private equity connections can really help, or those Washington connections can really help a private equity firm. Cerberus, a PE firm, hired John Snow as chairman months after he left Bush's administration, meaning the second Bush, George W. And GMAC, a Cerberus-owned company, and Chrysler both got into trouble, both looked for bailout funds. And in the case of GMAC, the government in the last days of the President Bush's administration allowed GMAC to convert from an auto leasing company basically to a bank. As a bank, GMAC then could receive TARP funds. And this was even though GMAC did not have enough capital in reserve to meet typical bank holding requirements. And at the same time, much of their business was an auto financing, which is not well diversified, which doesn't make for a good bank. And now, since they got that special status, it's amazing the government has bailed out GMAC, I think, two or three times to the tune of more than $12 billion to a company that, you know, arguably should have been never allowed to receive TARP money. And I would probably say is not that important to our country. Why can't someone else set up an auto leasing business?
There are tax loopholes that private equity firms benefit from that you would like to see closed. What changes would you like to see made?
The biggest one is interest tax deductibility. In the late 80s, it is something that Congress considered. And that is the ability of a company to not pay taxes on the interest it pays on its loans. I would like to see that, you know, that loophole was there. It wasn't a loophole. It was intended so that companies could borrow money to build a plant, to buy new equipment. It wasn't intended so you could borrow money to finance a takeover. If you eliminated interest tax deductibility just for corporate takeovers, which would really only impact the private equity firms, you would do a lot to make LBOs unprofitable. And buyouts have I think there is a track record that the core practice doesn't work. And if you ended this tax loophole, if you ended the interest tax deductibility on corporate takeovers, you would basically make LBOs unprofitable and you would basically end the industry.
The Obama administration is basically looking into that.
Yes, I'm very pleased to see that the president has appointed Paul Volcker to consider the whole tax code, and interest tax deductibility is on the table. I would think they would take a serious look at it. I believe I'm the only one so far that I've seen that's come up with at least an estimate of how much the government has lost because of this loophole. And this decade, it looks like they'll lose about $70 billion from companies that pay much less in taxes because they take on all this debt. A study that came out after I wrote the book shows that private equity-owned companies pay about half in taxes, about half their tax rate is about half of their competitors. It was a great study. It was done by a Notre Dame professor. So I think the government can certainly raise by closing the loophole, it'll generate a lot more money, certainly tens of billions, maybe even $100 billion. And the only purpose of this deductibility is to allow LBOs to happen. And I think in the 30 years that the LBO industry has been around, they certainly haven't proven that they've helped companies.
How do you know that the companies that have gone under or are struggling now, companies that were bought by private equity firms, how do you know they weren't going to struggle or go under anyways? Or maybe they would have gone under sooner. Or maybe the ones that are struggling would have gone under. And, you know, the scenario is actually better than it would have been, even though it's a bleak scenario.
In most of these cases, well, in almost all these cases, private equity firms like to say that they help restructure companies. Reality is the companies they buy need to be healthy to begin with or they can't do the LBO. Those companies are taking on so much debt to finance their own sales that these are healthy businesses. So I think in most cases, I mean, I will certainly take a step back. I'm one journalist who did 2 years of homework. But I think in the evidence that I saw, I think there is a lot of evidence that private equity firms hurt companies. Their returns to their investors, to the pensions, is under the Standard & Poor's 500. So they're buying companies on leverage, like if we bought houses on leverage. And yet their returns are worse than the S&P 500. And if you just bought stocks in the S&P 500 and levered them up, you'd make three, four times the money the private equity firms do. So they don't even make good returns for their investors. So I think, you know, to me, on many different levels, it's pretty clear that they don't improve companies. And I believe the companies that they acquire need to be – almost all the time need to be healthy to begin with or they can't acquire them. So these are not companies that were necessarily veering towards bankruptcy.
Well, Josh Kosman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the interest.
Josh Kosman is a financial reporter for the New York Post. His new book about private equity firms is called The Buyout of America. Last week, Woody Harrelson told us about his new film, The Messenger. Now we have part two of his interview with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. For 8 seasons, Harrelson played a lovable and naive bartender in the TV series Cheers. Then he made the films White Men Can't Jump, Indecent Proposal, Natural Born Killers, Kingpin, and The People vs. Larry Flint, which earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. He moved to Costa Rica for a while to flee celebrity, then settled in Hawaii with his family and took 5 years off from acting. He's become a vegan and an outspoken advocate of environmental causes. But he's back in movies. He had a memorable supporting role in No Country for Old Men, and he's now in the comedy Zombieland and the drama The Messenger, in which he and Ben Foster play soldiers assigned to tell family members that a loved one has died in action. Let's start with a clip from his first scene on Cheers. The scene starts with Ted Danson as Sam Malone.
What, did you say you're looking for work?
Well, actually, I came to Boston on a fact-finding tour. See, I tend bar back home in Indiana. Well, it's not a bar exactly. It's more like a pigsty with a jukebox. If we had a jukebox.
Carla, I'd like you to meet Woody Boyd. Woody, this is Carla Tortelli.
Hi, ma'am.
Ma'am? What's that supposed to mean?
I believe it's a term of respect.
I wonder it sounded so weird.
The character that you played, Woody Boyd, was sort of this lovable, naive hayseed from Indiana. And, you know, it occurred to me that you got this huge role at a pretty early time in your acting career, not like you didn't pay some dues. I know that you did, you know, plays in New York, but you had a lot more success in your 20s than a lot of people did. And I'm wondering if being in Hollywood then, you grew up in Ohio, I guess, and playing
Texas and Ohio.
Texas and Ohio, right. And that being in Hollywood then and having that role, were you a little wide-eyed like Woody Boyd?
Yeah, I suppose I was. I was, I just turned 24 when they started. I was 23 when I auditioned for it, but it was right just before my birthday. And then, I don't know, doing it, I got to say, I didn't have the full realization of, well, I'm replacing this beloved character. I mean, I kind of knew that, but I hadn't watched the show, so I didn't really know, you know, that much. I think it would have been a lot more of a daunting task had I been watching the show. But certainly, I remember standing back off stage waiting for that red light to go on, and, you know, I could hear the dialogue, and I could tell it was getting closer, and then, boom, the red light goes on, and I'm entering into the bar in front of a live audience, and obviously a show that's going to be seen by a lot of people, so it was pretty, I was nervous, I got to say. But thankfully, you know, I'd done enough theater in college that I think it really helped me get through that.
After Cheers, you made a transition to movies in a way that not that many TV actors do as successfully. And one of your early films was White Men Can't Jump, and I thought we'd listen to that. I think it really put you on the map as a movie actor, and I thought we would listen to a clip from that. And this is you and your co-star Wesley Snipes. I mean, those who know the film know that you guys are basketball hustlers. You go onto playground and provoke games and fool people and take their money. And in this scene, you're about to compete with Wesley as a partner in a two-on-two basketball tournament, and you suddenly start talking trash to a couple of guys on the court whom you might have to play later. Let's listen.
Hey, chump. Yeah, you, potato head. You know who I'm talking about. Is that the best game you got? Because if it is, you better just grab that free T-shirt and head home.
Yeah, man, what the hell are you doing, man?
You hit, who'd you bring over here? Mighty Mouse? Hey, you know wrong, something? You're wrong. Too pretty to play basketball. You know that? You got that big Z in your fro, man.
Come on, would you stop already?
Hey, man, what are you, the Black Zorro?
Oh, man, look, that's enough.
Hey, no, seriously. Hey. You get your hair cut at the Braille Institute?
What the f*** is Opie Taylor talking about anyway, huh?
Opie Taylor? Opie, hey, I got your Opie, you big, bad, gomer pot, droopy-eyed son of a bitch.
You and the cream and wheat man, yeah. Take your ass back to Mayberry and tell Aunt B she better have my bean pies or I'm going to kick her ass.
What are you doing?
Hey, lurching more tissue?
What are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing two things.
What? What are you doing?
I'm making them mad. Most guys don't play good when they're mad.
Look, you know you're embarrassing me. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing I'm doing.
You know, you're not embarrassing me. You are pissing me off. That's what you're doing.
Well, good, because unlike those guys, I assume you play better when you're mad. Am I right?
I'm not listening to you.
Yeah, but you are hearing me.
And that is my guest, Woody Harrelson, with Wesley Snipes from the movie White Men Can't Jump. A lot of fun macho trash talk there. But you know, a character really different from Woody Boyd on Cheers. And, you know, I have to say, when I think of a Woody Harrelson role, what I think of is a guy who brings enormous self-confidence, just not a moment of self-doubt. I mean, the kind of guy that could start trash-talking on the basketball court. Is that closer to you than this naive kid from Cheers?
You know, maybe somewhere right in the middle. I don't feel as confident as that. I don't remember. Well, I guess I do some trash-talking, but, you know, I feel a lot like that character, Billy Hoyle. Yeah, I guess so.
Well, let's talk a little bit about The People versus Larry Flint. This was a role that got you an Oscar nomination. I mean, Larry Flint was, of course, the publisher of Hustler magazine, who was shot and paralyzed from the waist down. I believe the assailant was never actually caught. And you played him in this film about his battles against censorship, as well as it's, you know, a profile of his very interesting life. I thought we should listen to a cut here. In a way, you kind of had two. There were sort of two roles here. I mean, you had to play the Larry Flint before he was injured, and the one after. And the one after, the gunshot wounds affected his speech. And in this cut from the film, you've just come back to Hustler magazine after being either in jail for contempt in one of the court cases or in the hospital, I'm not sure which, but you've come back to the magazine and sort of taken charge. Let's listen.
The pervert is back. The pervert is back.
Circulation is down by a third. Color reproduction is horrible. Models look like they're $3 whores. The writing is by some moronic idiots.
Mr. Flint? I don't want to step on your toes, but things have changed since you were actively running the company. I mean, I look back at the stuff you did in the 70s, and it was sort of racy and crazy. But the country's different now. Reagan has rebuilt America, and the moral majority is gaining power.
You're fired.
Excuse me?
You get the f*** out of my building, Doug! Get him out of here! Need to blow dry jerk. Take him out of here, throw him in the incinerator, cut him to little pieces and feed him to the animals out there. Get out of here!
There! Larry! Larry, you can't do that. I mean, he's our vice president. He's the VP of marketing.
Hey, Jimbo, are you trying to challenge my authority? You see that on the wall? LFP. That's Larry Flint Publications. Not JFP. Okay, I'm the big kahuna here. Do you have a problem with that?
No, Larry. You're the boss. So, Larry, what's the plan?
Plan. Plan is simple. The establishment took my manhood from me, but they left half of me. They left the half with the brain, and I'm going to use it to get back.
And that's my guest, Woody Harrelson, making his mark as Larry Flint, the porn publisher in the film The People versus Larry Flint. Tell us, what interested you about doing this film?
Well, you know, when they offered it to me, I was I kind of had a similar opinion most people had, which when they heard it, they said, well, why would you want to do a movie about this guy? And yet, you know, they were, and Milos Forman was going to direct it, so it really seemed like something you got to pay attention to. So I went and met with Larry, and my feeling was if I didn't like him, I just wasn't going to play the part. But I was kind of amazed by him. You know, he's a brilliantly funny, interesting guy who likes to stir things up, and yet, you know, whether or not you agree with what he does, he's a kind of a fascinating character. So I was glad to get time with him. And then when we started to make it, there was a lot of work to be done because the script just needed a lot of work. And there ended up being a lot of improv in it. And that was fun listening to that scene because that was my brother in that scene. He played Jimmy Flint.
Do you identify with Larry Flint in any way? I mean, you're both people who sort of aren't afraid of stirring things up and setting your own course.
Well, I think probably during the course of it, he kind of activated me more. Just for having played him, it made me, you know, it was after that that I did things where I had brushes with the law and so forth that, you know, probably I never would have done that.
Maybe you should explain what you mean by brushes with the law.
Well, for example, I was upset by the fact that there was no distinction made between hemp and marijuana, where I think in a free country you should be free to grow whatever, but I'm not going to pretend this is a free country. But however, I went to Kentucky, and along with my buddy Joe Hickey there, we kind of set up this thing where I planted hemp seeds and got arrested. And then the concept of it was to go to trial, which we ultimately did, and hopefully the jury would see the distinction between the two and, you know, farmers would be free to grow hemp, which you can use for paper or clothing or, you know, it's a sustainable material. So that's what ended up happening. And doing things like that or climbing the Golden Gate Bridge, I don't know if I ever would have done that kind of thing had I not played Larry, just because it made me look at things differently. Before, the thought of getting arrested was just an impossible thought, and I would never intentionally do that. And after playing the part, I looked at it as a way to kind of get my point across, you know.
Right, because Larry Flint, in fact, actively provoked the authorities and including insulting judges in courtrooms at times. We should mention that the you mentioned climbing the Golden Gate Bridge. That was, to string a banner protesting the eradication of redwoods, right?
Yeah, we were protesting the logging of the ancient redwoods in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure we helped any, but, you know, we tried to bring some attention to it.
I read, too, that there was a time when you were having a rough time with Laura Louie, your wife, although then I guess you weren't married, And you spoke to Larry about it, and I think he even might have spoken to her.
Yeah, Larry took it upon himself, unbeknownst to me, and called up Laura and got together with her and actually was giving relationship advice because I guess he considered her, you know, being my wife comparable to what it would be like to be Larry's wife. I'm not sure why. But it was really, it was one of those incredible, you know, things a true friend does, you know, that you just, I was really grateful for that. And I think it did help.
Do you want to share the advice he offered?
No, not at all.
People who know you well know that your father, who I guess divorced from your mom at an early age, was imprisoned. He was convicted of killing a federal judge. And I know that you had a relationship with him and visited him in prison and tried to help him get a new trial because you felt that it did not have a fair trial, died 2 years ago. But it's interesting to me, as I've read what you've said about him, that he was a charming, well-read, really interesting guy. And it struck me that, you know, one might say a lot of those same things about you, and you're both guys who aren't afraid to break some rules. Do you feel like you're like your dad in some way?
Well, I guess you could say, you know, they have the saying, the Japanese, there's some kind of Japanese philosophy that when you're born on your father's birthday, you're not like your father, you are your father. So I don't know. I remember hearing that. It's kind of interesting one time. And I do think that there are a lot of similarities. I think he had a much different kind of sense about what he needed to do to make money in life. And who knows what would have happened to me if I hadn't fallen into acting. So in that sense, we might have been exactly the same. But fortunately, I ran down this alleyway. And what about him? You know, he was an incredible guy in many ways. And, you know, he did a lot that probably nobody could be proud of. But so be it. You know, I still loved him. And it was really sad for me that he died in prison. And we never got to go hang out and have a beer together and, you know, just shoot the without being on telephones or having things monitored, you know?
Mm-hmm. You had a stretch for a few years where you weren't making films, right? You've made several recently. What made you want to take some time away from movie making?
Well, I mean, a part of it was after Larry Flint and this whole debacle where the movie was kind of destined to do quite well and then a whole campaign against it destroyed any chance of that, and the studio at the time didn't really fight it. They just kind of let it go, and it was really devastating because that movie meant a lot, and myself and Ed Norton, Courtney Love, and Milos, we put tons of work into that and tons of ourselves into that, and that was kind of a devastating blow. Also, I'd done movies back to back to back, and I was not enjoying it. Like, this is a job you should be enjoying. So it was a good opportunity to do another important thing, which was, and the most important of all of it, which was to hang more with my family. And so that's what I did. You know, we moved off grid and out of sight and just had a ball together. So one of my better decisions. I didn't think it was going to be 5 years, but I thought it would be a couple, 3 years. And then it was just fun. And, you know, I'll say this. I'm a good worker and a hard worker, but I'm a world-class vacationer.
Good to
slacker.
Have that talent, yeah. are you having fun with the job again?
Oh, yeah. I'm really enjoying it now. And I've just wanted to make sure that every movie that comes along, I just try to do my very best, and also that the movie has every chance of being great. And in this case, with The Messenger, I think it's the best movie I've been a part of. I think it's truly great, and Oren Moverman is like a young Hal Ashby, and he just truly, you know, one of the most visionary directors I've ever worked with. And Ben Foster, I think, delivers just this searing, beautiful, eloquent performance. And it's great to be a part of it.
We're about out of time, but Woody Harrelson, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure being on your show.
Woody Harrelson spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Dave is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Woody Harrelson stars with Ben Foster in the new movie, The Messenger.